Josh Phillips is a senior investigative reporter with Epoch Times. We're talking to him today about the coronavirus. Josh, tell us about the coronavirus. First of all, when was it first detected, first discovered?
So initial reports were claiming it came from this Chinese seafood market, but it's now turning out that the initial reports had nothing to do with the seafood market. This came from December 8, actually, and the first case was traced to December 1st. It turns out that people who were talking about it in China were being arrested. Eight doctors were arrested for talking about it. And so it appears there was a cover-up for a long time. And, you know, kind of late in the game, the Chinese authorities did respond to it. By that time, pretty much 5 million people had already left Wuhan. They locked down the city, and we're in a pretty difficult situation now as it stands.
What caused this coronavirus?
There's mixed analysis. Initial reports were claiming it came from a live seafood or a live animal market. You know, there was the bat soup rumor. That does not appear to be accurate, although bats do carry a type of coronavirus. Currently, the origin is unknown. There has been lots of speculation. Some people say it's a bioweapon that escaped a lab. Some say it was a vaccine experiment escaped a lab. Keep in mind that one of China's main laboratories that researches viruses like these, a P4 laboratory, is in Wuhan, about 20 miles away from that market that they said the case originally started from. At this time, though, we do not know where it, we can't say for sure where it actually came from.
Josh, how disturbing is it that people are not sure where it came from?
It's pretty disturbing. Some people have noted that there's a couple issues. When you're talking about the Chinese Communist Party's narrative that it came from this live market, that's problematic because they shut down the live market, which means that when foreign inspectors go there and go and see what happened, it's shut down. There's nothing there to look at, nothing to see. So there's no way for them to trace it. Some analysts have noted that if it did in fact come from the market, as Chinese authorities were saying, the way they shut it down would have exacerbated the problem because you have all these pests like rats, different types of, fecal matter, different types of things. Even it's rumors now that it, you know, could be spread through even blood supplies because pregnant women are transmitting it to their babies in China, allegedly. And so if they did not clean up that market properly, it would have actually spread the virus even worse. And it appears they pretty hastily shut it down. But if it's a bioweapon, if it was something escaped from this lab, it's even a bigger deal. Even if it wasn't a bioweapon, even if it did escape from the lab through normal means, it's pretty bad on the Chinese Communist Party that, you know, a slip-up would have allowed something like that to happen. So we'll have to see what the final verdict is, but it's not looking good for the Chinese Communist Party.
Josh, how does it spread? How do humans get it?
Well, it's a coronavirus, like a flu. It's about, analysis is showing it's about 79% similar to the SARS virus, which in early 2000s was sickening people across China. Coughing, sneezing, that kind of thing. But it appears that it's even worse than SARS in some regards. There have been reports that even, for example, bodily fluids, like even the fluid on your eyes could carry it, you know, to that extent. As I mentioned, there were reports just recently in China, I think yesterday, within the last couple of days, saying that women are transmitting it to unborn babies, meaning that it could be contained even in the blood supply, which means that if you get this virus, it's not just something in the lungs. This is a bit more serious than any kind of common coronavirus.
How deadly is it?
The various estimates. Now, the Chinese Communist Party is reporting fairly low numbers, still higher than what they reported on SARS. Even with SARS, there was a cover-up. If you look at Western analysis and leaked numbers, some say as high as 10% death rate. We can't say for sure, mainly because the numbers coming out of China are not reliable. There have been videos of people in China at the hospitals showing bodies and, you know, bodies stacked, bodies next to patients, you know, living and dead next to each other. That we actually, Epoch Times, we just made phone calls into Wuhan. They said the crematoriums are working 24/7 to dispose of bodies. There are some mathematical estimates on what that would mean. Some put the death rate as high as 24,000-ish. But if you look at Chinese official numbers, it's only in a few hundred.
How is it treated, and should people in Western countries and in America worry?
that there is currently no official treatment for the new coronavirus. But doctors in Thailand claim that they've been able to treat it using drugs for the normal flu and AIDS. There are some people who broke down the sequence of the virus and showed some very peculiar things, which I mentioned before. There are rumors it did come from a lab. There is evidence of, let's say, human manipulation within the sequence of the virus. Rumors, according to some scientific analysis, I should say, showing that it may even have parts of the AIDS virus in it, which is pretty peculiar. But given that some doctors are reporting the AIDS drugs do help treat it, there might be something there.
Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to diagnose, and is there a problem with doctors misdiagnosing this?
So in China right now, they're using these testing kits to diagnose the virus, and there are various reports on this. One of the big problems is that early on, the Chinese Communist Party had limited numbers of testing kits. And so, in other words, the number of cases they were even capable of reporting were limited to the number of testing kits they were being given. And if people were not able to be tested, they were told, go home, quarantine yourself, lay down. They were not given a hospital bed. They were not counted among the numbers. There are two conflicting reports now. Epoch Times actually had an article noting this conflict in reporting, that the Chinese official state media is claiming on one end that they now have more testing kits than patients, and so there's no issue with diagnosing. But local reports from Wuhan, where the city has been locked down and it's kind of the epicenter of the virus, doctors are saying that they don't have nearly enough testing kits and there's no way they can track the number of cases.
Josh, why does this seem to keep happening in China? There's lots of poverty in the world. There are a lot of third world countries. Why China?
Hard to say. I mean, again, this goes back to speculation on one end that this was a virus that escaped one of the labs. And keep in mind that China's first level 4 virus research facility is located in Wuhan. That's the P4 lab, which is under the Chinese Academy of Sciences, which does in fact have some ties to the People's Liberation Army, the official military of the Communist Party. If you want to get into why it's happening in China, other than the possibility of an escape, well, hard to say. I mean, why? That's a good question to ask. Why is it happening there and not other third world countries, other places where you do have poverty and maybe not the cleanest conditions? Some would blame it on the types of foods, such as this food market, where they're eating creatures that a lot of people would not eat. But at the same time, if you look at other countries that do have similar types of food markets, you haven't had those issues there. So hard to say. Nothing conclusive yet. We'll have to see.
Josh, is the U.S. government advising people not to go to China?
Currently, there is a quarantine in place of people traveling from China to the United States. Taiwan as well also has a quarantine in place. People traveling from the mainland to Taiwan have to be quarantined for 14 days. With the U.S., it's a travel restriction. Many countries now are becoming a lot more cautious with people coming from Wuhan especially. We'll see if it's too little too late. The virus has already spread international.
Finally, Josh, how does this end?
How does it end? Hard to say. Well, it's going to end in a few ways. One, we're going to have to see whether the Chinese numbers are accurate, because if they're not accurate and the virus is more widespread than initially thought, it could be spreading outside of China, and it's possible that the quarantine internally was not enough. Hopefully that will not happen. There's also a possibility that people in China are going to wake up and see the Chinese Communist Party for what it is, because you have close to 30 cities on lockdown now in China to various extents. Reports and videos of people being rounded up, thrown in these police vans. People in Wuhan especially not wanting to go to the hospital anymore because for example, this recent hospital they built in 10 days with 1,000 beds in it is allegedly a quarantine zone under control of the People's Liberation Army. Well, officially under control of the People's Liberation Army. People are afraid of going to it. And people also, you have Chinese police going door to door and taking people who show symptoms of the virus. And so people are not trusting right now of Chinese authorities.
Josh Phillips, senior investigative reporter, Epoch Times. Josh, thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Hey, real pleasure. Thank you.
I mean, when you find out that all the crematoriums of Hubei are backed up and cannot take bodies, and the bodies are stacking up, waiting for the crematoria, you know the numbers are enormous. And we know that the official numbers coming out are not accurate. A lot more of Xi's future is resting on how he deals with this epidemic. You know, if the party screws this up, the economic and political repercussions are going to be enormous. And many would argue they already did. I mean, certainly that's the implication that all of Li Wenliang's mourners have taken from his martyrdom,
right,
that he was killed by the party, essentially. Its unwillingness to allow him to warn all of us about this epidemic and the unwillingness of the party officials inside Wuhan to take seriously the warning that he and other doctors, at least eight of them, were all either jailed or forced to sign these confessions of rumor mongering.
Just how big a threat is the current coronavirus outbreak? This through the eyes of a reporter who has worked in over 30 epidemic zones, including SARS in China and Ebola in West Africa. How can coronavirus be transmitted? How virulent is it? And how does it compare with SARS and MERS and the 1918 influenza pandemic? How has the Chinese regime's cover-up of information contributed to the outbreak? And what are the best precautions to avoid infection? This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kelek. In this episode, we'll sit down with Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Lori Garrett, an expert on epidemics who is also a columnist for Foreign Policy. Lori Garrett, really great to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thank you.
And I'm not going to actually shake your hand.
No.
Because I've read your article about how to protect oneself from coronavirus and other things as well. It's incredible. You're an expert on outbreaks and pandemics. You've actually traveled to something like 30 of them. When one happens, most people are running away. You're running towards it.
That's right. I get all the tourist sites to myself.
But in all seriousness, I came across this article of yours recently, which basically talks about preventative measures, how to protect yourself against coronavirus, or as we call it now,
COVID-19.
COVID-19. We can talk about the naming in a moment. And I wanted to start with that because my sense and the sense of our reporting is that it's going to get a lot bigger. And I think we want to know how to protect ourselves from someone who, you know, has become an expert at doing that. So tell me, what do you do?
You know, it depends who the you is. Okay. So let's just put healthcare workers in a separate box, and we're talking about everybody else now.
Okay.
So I'm not talking about what EMT does, the ambulance drivers, police officers involved in picking people up who are sick, that sort of thing. Separate box.
Okay.
But for the average person, you and I, out on the streets, going about our day, how do we protect ourselves? And the most important principle is to remember that coronaviruses, which this new COVID-19 is one of, is a family of viruses that account for about half of all common colds. So the first thing is to ask yourself, when your four-year-old comes home from nursery school coughing and sneezing, how long does it take for your whole family to get infected? All right, now, is there anything you ever do in your household and in your way of functioning as a family that reduces that chance of everybody in the household getting infected with a cold? Similarly, at the office, there's always that guy who comes back from Christmas vacation wheezing and sneezing and thinks that it's a better part of valor to go to the office. Thank you very much. You just infected all of us at work. How long does it take to sweep through the office? And how does it sweep through the office or the school or the playgroup or whatever it may be?
Sure.
So if you think about it in terms of a benign virus like a common cold, maybe it takes a little of the scare element out and you can focus on the biology. So let's talk about it that way because
okay.
I think it's easier for people. When you're terrified, you make very poor judgments. So let's think about it like not getting a common cold. And let's start with the home. one of the biggest mistakes in households and families is there's a tendency to share towels, your kitchen towels, your bathroom towels. Nobody's names are on the towels. And towels are just fantastic surfaces for growing viruses and bacteria. They're moist, they have food for the microbes on them, they readily transfer, and you rub hard on them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what a towel is. So you really grind those into your hands or your face. And in doing that, you're transferring whatever's on that towel right up your nose, in your mouth, in your eyes. You just infected yourself. So first step is separate all those moist towels so that everybody knows which ones are theirs in the household, or replace them at the office with paper towels. Step one. Step two, within the household, if there's someone who has a cold, one of the major ways it spreads in the household is on doorknobs.
Okay.
Because what do you do when you're sick? You go and then you turn the doorknob. You just transferred from your mouth, your lungs, to your hands, to the doorknob. And now the doorknob, for perhaps 3 or 4 hours, depending on the temperature, is a surface that is contaminated.
And this 3 to 4 hours, that's for COVID-19, or is that for?
We're still trying to figure all this out with mm-hmm. COVID-19, okay. But it's probably about the same.
Okay.
And of course, that varies. If it's hotter outside and the surface is exposed to ultraviolet light from the sun, then viruses die faster. If it's darker, cooler, viruses can live longer on a surface. Now you're holding a tablet. Now you hand that tablet to me because I'm going to look at something on your tablet. Mm-hmm. Oh, I just touched the back of the tablet where your hand was. You just gave me your virus. So another way that common colds spread is by sharing physical items spread from a contaminated hand through a cell phone, through a shared pen, shared utensils, shared drinking cup, all these things. You have to think about it and say, no, all this stops now. And of course, if you're a school teacher, you have to teach children not to do this. Which is very difficult the younger they are. I mean, basically a two-year-old is a little slobbering, stick-it-in-its-mouth object. And it's very hard to discipline a two-year-old not to spread disease.
Right.
But by the time they're 4 or 5, they really need to be learning these lessons. And they need to learn it by watching you. And so mom and dad do the right thing, the little ones do too. But if mom and dad are all sloppy about all this and don't use only the towel with their name on it, and carefully, when they're sick, cough not into your hand but into your armpit so that you don't shake hands here, you don't open a door here, you do it with this. The less you can have this contacting your face, the better. And I think it's really hard, you know, people don't realize how unconsciously they in fact touch their face all the time. You don't think about this, you know, or just a little scratch, or, oh, something's in my eye. Well, if your hands are contaminated, each one of those acts is a potential transfer of infection. So if you just very consciously think about these things, you realize, well, I have to wash my hands a lot. You bet. And, you know, at the CDC, they have our Centers for Disease Control, they have a maxim or a little rule. They say, if there's a virus spreading around, you need to use not scalding hot, but more than warm water and soap, and you need to scrub as long as it takes to sing happy birthday twice. That's easy to teach kids.
Right, that's longer than I usually do
than
it.
Than any of us usually do.
Yeah, frankly.
And, you know, similarly, when you're in the shower or cleaning, anything where you're bathing, you know, you have to think more what really matters. It's your face and hands, face and hands, face and hands.
One of the counterintuitive things that I read, you see, you know, I think the world is sold out of face masks,
yeah,
or something like this, right? Right now, they can't make them fast enough. But you're saying that especially outdoors and maybe even indoors, you don't wear a mask when you go into these places. Mm-mm. This is really interesting to me. Tell me about this.
I mean, I'm more likely to wear a dust mask when I'm in air pollution in China than I am to wear a face mask to protect myself from disease. First of all, there are very few that work. And I was part of a large study commissioned by the Sloan Foundation a few years ago, where we were thinking about influenza pandemics.
Okay.
And we kind of went through the list of every kind of mask out there. And it's pretty clear, as soon as even the most sophisticated N95 or surgical masks get moist, you see a rapid reduction in the efficiency of blocking virus with the mask. The various fibers and filaments that are meshed together in the mask very quickly with moisture begin to separate and create, you know, larger gaps for viruses to come in. You think about it, it makes perfect sense. Well, what happens when you wear a mask for 4 hours? You're basically recycling what it smells like and what's inside your mouth over and over again onto the inner surface of the mask. And not only does it stink and get pretty disgusting after a while, but you're also exhaling moisture. So the whole mask begins to deteriorate fairly quickly. Some have argued that it's basically a window of about 4 hours in most conditions that it's effective. And then it begins seriously to deteriorate in efficacy from there. I would say the most, outside of the surgical theater and, you know, the direct medical setting, but in average everyday use, probably the greatest thing a mask does is remind the person looking at you to be nervous. So it may not actually protect you in the sense that it's forming an effective barrier against the virus. And when you look at what most people are wearing now in China, I mean, they're loose on the sides, virus can get in, they're loose on the top, they're not really antiviral masks. Many of them were meant to be for allergies, keeping out, you know, what compared to a virus is a gigantic dust particle. Many were meant to be used by construction workers to keep sawdust out and so on. So they're not really antiviral masks, and they're probably not really doing them much good at all. However, they do have the effect of raising the alarm of the person who sees you. And that may result in the thing that really does work, which is social distancing. You and I have an appropriate social distance right now. So even if you were coughing, unless you were just really having a coughing fit, odds are I'm okay.
Okay. That's very, very interesting. So, you know, let's say you were going to China. Actually, maybe you might be, I don't know. But if you were going to China right now, and you were going to step out into Wuhan, you were allowed to do that, what would you be wearing?
Well, I wouldn't have any choice. It's against the law not to wear a mask. Mm-hmm. It's against the law not to have gloves on. Mm-hmm. So I would actually have to wear all that sort
but
of stuff.
But the gloves are something that you recommend, if
yes,
I recall.
Yes, but right? I mean latex gloves.
Right.
And, you know, now that you mention that, a lot of people have never actually worn latex gloves before, and they may not realize that they're allergic. And the allergy to latex is fairly common. It's not rare at all. There are physicians and nurses that have had to change their whole careers because they develop such acute allergies to latex. I have a colleague who's an MD in Australia who developed such profound allergy to latex that it not only affected her ability to work as a physician, but she can't eat in most restaurants if the cooking staff wears latex when they prepare the food.
Wow. So in this case, you're wearing cloth?
I would have, if the law was, or if I was in a situation where I knew people would be very upset that I didn't have latex gloves on, then I would put them on. But, you know, they're not as protective as people think. I was once in a situation in an Ebola epidemic in Congo, where I was trying to understand how the virus had spread in this particular village in a remote area. And I wanted to be polite to the surviving families. So when they brought in a big collective pot of food, I knew, you know, it's appropriate in this culture to grab with your hands, and but I didn't want to put my hands in a common pot when there's a virus circulating. So I, very thinking I was being a very wise solution, I distributed latex gloves to everybody and said, let's all protect ourselves while we eat. And I didn't even think about the fact that as soon as latex hits cooking oil, it completely deteriorates. Soon we all had these drippy glomp messes on our hands that were, of course, completely useless.
I see. Wow, that's remarkable. Let's talk about, in a more broader sense, transmissibility. What do we know right now about how COVID-19 is transmitted? Yeah.
And this is, again, a still evolving issue with a great deal of controversy associated with it. You know, when this all first started, the official position from China was that there was a very low probability of infection. You could only get infected from someone who had a high fever of over 38 C, so over like 99 plus Fahrenheit, and that you had to have very close contact with the individual. But now we're finding more and more cases that defy that set of comforting limitations. First of all, we know there's asymptomatic transmission. There are people who have whatever symptoms they may have are so minor that they don't even notice them themselves, which would be sort of the way it feels when you're just starting to get a cold. You have a little bit of achiness, maybe you're a little tired, but you're not coughing, you're not sneezing, you don't have a fever, and you're able to go about your day.
Wow.
It turns out they are contagious, or in some cases they are contagious. Secondly, there's more and more evidence of transmission aerosolized. So we know that all coronaviruses that have infected people that we know of are capable of being transmitted in droplets. So you have moisture in your lungs and certainly in your mouth, and the virus will be inside of microscopic size droplets of water and mucus, whatever fluids are in the body, and it will basically take a free ride hitchhiking as you out droplets.
So you might not even be coughing, you would just breathe out.
Yeah, just exhale.
Right.
And it'd be in these droplets. But we also know these droplets can't go far.
Okay.
You know, they're heavy and they just kind of, unless there's a big wind behind you, you know, taking them a fairer distance. But now there's a couple of papers just came out this week from China that implicate transmission of virus without that droplet carrier. So that would mean it's a little closer to influenza. And it also could mean that virus would suspend in a space in the air, circulating around in air currents in a room like this for some limited amount of time, but enough time that we should be anxious about it. And we don't really know the details. I mean, I don't want to scare the dickens out of people. And I think it's really important to be clear what looks irrefutably true and what is still, you know, if and maybe. The other thing that has definitely been shown in several different studies is that the virus is present in feces of people who are sick. So that opens the door to a whole kind of set of transmissions that again go back to dirty hands, but would liken it more to how you spread cholera, how you spread norovirus, dysentery viruses, and so on.
Right.
And that may explain why it's been so hard to stop the spread of it on that cruise ship off of Yokohama. I think last I looked, it was something like 135 people were infected, most of them clearly infected after they were aware that it was there, and they placed everybody under quarantine. They're stuck in their rooms. How in the world are they getting infected? Well, it's probably because of the crew. And those that are asymptomatically infected but may be passing virus in their feces, which means possibly on their hands, and then they're doing food preparation. And these sorts of things are very difficult to control because it's just it's human behavior, and we all behave without thinking about it, you know?
Right.
I mean, if you have to consciously wash your hands before you touch anything in the kitchen, and after you finish preparing everything in the kitchen, you're already breaking normal behavior patterns for most people. And the other, of course, we know the people most at risk for coronaviruses generally, and certainly for this virus, are healthcare workers. So anybody who's actively engaged in trying to treat patients is at very high risk. And the procedures involved in what little treatment we have, and we don't have a treatment really, we don't have a magic medicine, we don't have a terrific vaccine, we don't have some, you know, symptom treatment that's just fantastic. It doesn't exist. But for what we do as a palliative care and provision of oxygen and so on, these are all tools that require very close contact with the patient and with precisely the source of infection, the mouth, the nose, the eyes, the face, and the bedpans and all these things that can be very dangerous for healthcare workers. Now, one of the things that has caused a lot of concern among those trying to understand the dynamics of this epidemic is that the Chinese government has not disaggregated the data they provide on infections and deaths by profession or category that is useful. So just today, it's being reported in the South China Morning Post that 500 healthcare workers in Wuhan alone have come down with this virus. We don't know how many of them have died. We certainly know Li Wenliang died, and he was only 34 years old. So the myth that the data, the little bits of disaggregation we have received, is that the only people who get really sick are elderly, and they have some other underlying disease issues, such as heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and so on, that makes them frail and more vulnerable. But you know, when you see that young, very healthy, vibrant, robust young man dying at the age of 34, you know, somebody's not giving you the straight poop.
Our hearts go out to those workers in China right now. It must be an incredibly difficult situation.
Oh, you can't imagine. If you've never been in an epidemic and you've never seen the healthcare workers on the front lines, you cannot imagine how stressful it is. The only thing that comes close is being a soldier on a battlefront. It's nonstop. If they get 4 hours of real sleep a day, they're doing well. Because even when you have time off, you're so wound up, you're so filled with fear and emotional anxiety about everything you've seen, that it's very hard to sleep. And then, you know, barely have you fallen asleep, then it's time to get up and start all over again. And you're just seeing despair. And people are very emotional. The patient population is, and their families are freaked out. And it's unrelenting. There's just more today than there were yesterday, and there will be more tomorrow. And it's made all the worse when you don't have a toolkit for treating people, when you don't have a magic pill. So you're just seeing their own bodies doing battle, and you have to stand and watch and hope, you know, give them some water, some oxygen, and hope that body will manage to fight the virus off, but this one can't. It's a terrible thing to see. And it takes a toll on people, really does. And then if you add to that the unique set of tensions in China, where if you tell anybody what you're going through, you may end up in prison, where orders come from, you know, mysterious bureaucracies and individuals from the CCCP,
right.
And all of a sudden you're in trouble because you didn't do this procedure or you didn't fill out that paperwork or what have you. That's very frightening. It adds another level of stress and concern. And then one of the things people always forget about when they look at an epidemic and healthcare workers is they all have families. They all have loved ones. Many of them have small children at home. And they're worried about their families. And in many cases, out of a sense of protecting their families, they don't go home. So for weeks on end, months on end, however long it lasts, they're separated from their own children, their own households, their own families. They're worried like heck for them, but they think it's safer if they live in a dormitory at the hospital or someplace close by, and not potentially infect, you know, bring from the hospital to the home the virus. And so that's a whole other layer of emotional difficulty they're all struggling with. And I've seen many videos of doctors and nurses on their downtime using a tablet to talk to their children and to talk to grandma and grandpa and see, do you have food? Is anybody sick? What are you doing to stay occupied? To the kids, are you getting any schooling? Are you online with your teacher? What are you doing all day? And you know, you can't day after day look at your own children without just feeling your heart being tugged at. So these people are going through a hell, a true hell on earth. They've gone into Dante's Inferno.
You know, you mentioned, of course, that, you know, for the typical lay people, there's a certain way to protect yourself. We've seen these kind of hazmat type suits. I don't think it's quite a hazmat suit, but
no, it's not.
But it's
a PPE, personal protective equipment.
Right. So the people that would be, for example, coming hospital workers that would be coming back to family, and I can understand why they're not. Gosh, I imagine that might be something I would do. And then, you know, the EMTs and the police and the people who are doing the direct work. How is that different? Are they all wearing PPEs or?
Well. There is now a global supply crisis for PPEs. As of this week, we're running out everywhere in the world. And of course, where are they all made? For the most part, China. And so China's not exporting mass PPEs, any of this. This is all going for their own needs right now, which is appropriate. And certainly if I were Xi, one of the first things I would have said was, cease all export of the following medically essential products. And well, even so, they're not able to keep up with the needs level inside China. I don't know where PPEs are going to come from if we have this epidemic here, because we're not going to get them from China. And we don't manufacture them on site in America. We don't manufacture gloves and masks. All these are imported, packaged under an American company name, and end up on your drugstore shelves. Try looking for masks on your drugstore shelves today. I mean, Amazon has run out of masks.
Right.
Amazon's
I noticed
out
that.
Of all that. And
yeah.
The demand is there. Latex, there's a limited number of places that can do this because most of the rubber for latex comes from Malaysia and Indonesia, southern Asia, and the manufacturing sites are all in that region. So as the epidemic spreads in that region, you're going to see everything associated with latex and rubber begin to become scarce. And in China, they're already running out of respirators and pulmonary support equipment, oxygen tanks, all the only thing we really can do for someone who has pneumonia with this virus, because of course antibiotics don't work, that's for bacteria.
Right.
And we don't have a magic pill. So it's basically supportive therapy, how as their lungs fill with the fluids of their own immune system going to battle in the lungs with the virus, and the lungs may be, you know, this much air capacity normally, but as the fluids build up, the air capacity of the lungs shrinks, and it becomes harder and harder for the individual to get air. And you hear that classic sort of railed gasping, you know, trying to get air in the lungs. And so the best thing you can do for that person is to give them supportive oxygen. with either a nasal tube. You've seen these. And
right.
If you haven't been in a hospital, you've seen it on every single doctor TV show. Or a tube that goes in the mouth and down into the lungs. Just a mask delivering with compressed air going into as support. Well, all of that is running out in China now. And I've done some cursory checking around in the medical profession here in the United States, and we're in the midst of a very large flu epidemic here. And it's not a terribly dangerous flu, but with every flu, a certain percentage of people end up being hospitalized in intensive care
right.
and developing pneumonia. And our supply chain is already pretty taxed.
It's incredible to hear that. You know, you made me think of this now. You know, I've heard a number of people say this sort of thing, like, hey, influenza kills X number of people every year. You know, why are we so serious about coronavirus? And I found that kind of to be preposterous myself, but I'd love to hear what you think about this idea.
Every single epidemic, somebody raises the same canard or red herring, whatever you want to use, because it is, the whole point of epidemics is they're additive. It's an added burden on top of a pre-existing baseline of disease. And by being an added burden, it's also a burden you can't anticipate, you can't predict, you can't tell where it's going, you're making up on the spot how to respond to it, what to draw from your medical toolkit, from your public health toolkit. You may liken it to something like flu and say, well, this works for the flu, let's try it. But, you know, influenza, we do have drugs. We do have a fairly good understanding of how likely a given acute case of influenza will progress to secondary bacterial infection and require antibiotic support. Most physicians who work in pulmonary care, emergency care, or intensive care units know how to treat flu. That doesn't mean you always succeed. People every year die of influenza.
Right.
But this is a whole other ballgame. Very few healthcare workers live in dread fear of catching flu from their patients. But I'll tell you, there's not a health worker out there that isn't concerned about the possibility of catching COVID-19 from a patient. And I think a lot of people are paying attention to what happened in the UK with this
super spreader, right?
Yes, yeah. I hate
you don't
that
like
phrase.
That terminology. Well, it's one of the things I want to ask you about, so tell me about this.
Yeah. Well, the phrase super spreader gets applied to an individual who seems to be at the center of a large number of secondary infections. But the phrase, when said to the general public, sounds like that person is guilty of being a super spreader, as if they were malevolent, awful beings that went around super spreading.
Okay.
And therefore, I really don't like the phrase. It kind of stigmatizes quite automatically. But in this case, it was an individual who did not realize he was sick. He had attended a very high, fancy meeting that was in the fanciest hotel in Singapore, and unbeknownst to him, there was an outbreak beginning in Singapore, and it was in this hotel. And so several hotel workers took ill, and some other travelers, business people that were at this same meeting, later took ill. He did not have any symptoms. He then went from Singapore to the French Alps to have an alpine vacation with friends. And then from France to the UK to his home. And along the way, unwittingly infected several people. And then his general practitioner had to shut his whole practice down because I think last I saw it was 4 people in his office staff became infected from contact with the individual. And I think about this, I mean, I was just at the dentist this morning. And he greeted me with a handshake, and I, please don't.
Uh-huh.
And all his conversations with me, he had no mask on, and no gloves.
And of course, he's working on you. Right?
Well, he puts them on when he actually starts digging in your mouth. Okay. But up until then, it was a very, as we are now, right? And I was thinking, gosh, you know, what if a COVID-19 dental patient came in? You know, how fast would this spread in this little dental office to his secretary and his three hygiene assistants and those five people sitting in the waiting room and me? And I think most of our health providers are very naive, especially those that are in private practice. We haven't been slammed by a major super deadly epidemic in America except HIV, which, by the way, everybody handled improperly, dealt with improperly in the 1980s, because they had more disdain for those with the disease, for their homosexuality, than they did for the disease itself. And since I'm mentioning a dentist, we had the famous outbreak associated with an infected dentist in Florida who unintentionally spread the virus to many of his dental patients back in the 1980s. That led to, for the first time, dentists all wearing gloves and masks when they treated. Before then, believe it or not, bare hands went into your mouth as they poked around looking to see if you needed a cavity filled. And today that seems shocking, right? But that was the state of the art in the 1970s, early 80s, until HIV came along.
So how virulent is, from what we know, coronavirus? The name is very new, so
just
I don't
say coronavirus. That's fine.
Coronavirus compared to influenza, you know, the yearly influenza realities, from what we know right now.
Right. Again, a subject of debate, with variable results coming through from different parts of China. So we have this expression called R-naught, and it refers to a statistical analysis of the likelihood that my infection will replicate to be an infection to one more, add the cameraman two more, add the producer three more, add the sound guy four more. So how is an R naught of one means it's not growing. It's a one that I may infect you, but the net size of the epidemic remains stagnant. An R2 means it's doubling. So I infect two of you in the room, you infect two.
Over what time period?
Yeah.
Okay.
That depends on incubation, which is another reason why
I'm going to ask you about that in a moment.
It's all difficult to compute. So when you ask how dangerous, what's the rate of expansion of this epidemic, you know, the R-naught is hotly debated. Some are insisting it's around 1.5, maybe even just 1. But there are definitely indications of higher R-naughts. In one city in China, not Wuhan, another city, there's a very insistence that it's about 4.5, which is huge, and which is far beyond any garden variety influenza.
Okay.
Now, to put this in perspective, the R-naught of 1918 flu, which killed somewhere between 75 and 100 million people on Earth before commercial air travel and circumnavigated the planet three times in 18 months, right? That was an R-naught of less than 2.
This is going to get worse.
Oh, yeah.
This is what you're telling me.
Gabriel Leung is a very world-class famous epidemiologist who is also the dean of the Hong Kong University Medical School, and quite famous in Asia, also has an affiliation with Harvard University. I've had the great fortune of working with Gabriel on a number of projects over the years, and I saw him in action in SARS in Hong Kong, in bird flu in Hong Kong. He has walked this tightrope between confusing, if not deliberately obfuscated, information coming out of mainland as they're trying to make real-time decisions about how to protect people in Hong Kong. His analysis that he just released late last night, our time, is that this epidemic will go pandemic and could infect more than 60% of the human population with a 1% mortality rate, which would, you just do the math, you're talking about more than 100 million dead. Now, I just hope he's totally wrong.
Yeah, we're familiar with his acumen, and it's very strong. I hadn't realized that he had made that kind of a prediction, and it's not casual.
No, and I think right now we have far too much misinformation coming out of China to be able to really generalize and guess what's going to happen to the world. Some of it is, Communist Party guys trying to change the narrative and playing games with the information. And some of it is just innocent error because this pool of healthcare workers is shrinking. They're getting infected. They're having nervous breakdowns. They're freaking out. And the last thing they have time for is, okay, let me make sure I've got the right death count for today. I mean, when you find out that all the crematoriums of Hubei are backed up and cannot take bodies, and the bodies are stacking up, waiting for the crematoria, you know the numbers are enormous. But, and we know that the official numbers coming out are not accurate.
No, never in any area.
In any, what? They wouldn't be here on a minute by minute basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is really hard. This is really hard. But you add to it that there's clearly conflict within the leadership of the Communist Party right now. Xi is feeling very threatened. His power is feeling very threatened. And so the narrative keeps changing. I mean, just recently, in the last, 4 days, he fired the head of the whole epidemic response and replaced him with the head of security. So he's securitized the whole epidemic. It's gone from being a medical problem, a public health problem, to now a national security problem. Well, that means you've got the police running around doing things like welding people into their apartments, where I guess they're going to starve to death. And rounding people up. We've all seen the videos of people grabbed right off the streets in Beijing and stuck in these little metal boxes from which we hear them screaming. Where are they going? What's happening to these people? We don't really know. But I think we can now begin to really pay attention to Singapore, to that ship off of Yokohama.
Right.
To Japan and Hong Kong, and watch how this begins to play out in those locations. And I think even though the numbers will be much smaller because they're in really early stages, it will be a better guidance from which to make predictions and to assess things like what's the R-naught, what's the incubation time. We have a new report that puts incubation time out as far as 24 days. But, most of the official take is it's somewhere in the 3 to 5 day range. 3 to 5 days is bad enough if you're contagious during that time. Invisibly, asymptomatic.
Tell me, for most of us, it's unclear what the implications of 24 days of incubation time. How does that change the game?
Well, it changes the game two key ways. One is about how long you can infect others, and the other is the likelihood that you will be deemed safe, but actually are yourself in risk and danger, and you're going to come back through the system again and again, meaning you're going to be in medical facilities getting tested, maybe being submitted to some somewhat more invasive test, come up negative, go back out, come back in, go back out. And this means multiple opportunities for you to be a source of infection within a medical setting. But I think the real risk, and we don't know how big the risk is, and there's a lot of debate right now. But the real risk is that it's basically a prolonged window during which you can infect others and not be aware that you're a carrier. And that just becomes a total public health nightmare. I mean, one of the things you have to realize is, and think about this in the context of what if we get it here in the United States. We don't have a rapid diagnostic, right? I mean, it's easier for a woman right now to find out if she's pregnant, and she can do it cheap, fast, and accurate. That's easier than for me to find out if you have COVID-19.
Sounds like it's probably a lot easier, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like orders of magnitude.
Yeah, yeah.
Right now, the standard test that is available through our CDC and a version, a similar type of test available being used in China, does seem to have a false negative rate. Exactly how much of a false negative rate is a matter of debate.
False negative, just for the benefit of our audience, is you have it, but it doesn't show up
right,
in the test.
Right. Right. Okay. So you have an individual tested as not infected, but they are. That gives them more time to infect others. It takes about 4 to 5 hours of actual laboratory time. Add to that the processing time of bringing the individual in for testing, going through paperwork, etc. They wait in line. Now they get their test, and then you get the results, and now the bureaucratic forms need to be filled out, and now that individual needs to be advised. That whole process could be 8 hours in a block, or meaning come back tomorrow and we'll give you your results. And now we're hearing of shortages of test kits all over China.
Right.
And so there are samples backed up awaiting testing.
And there's just probably a lot of people that just aren't being tested that have a fever.
Well, if you didn't know you needed to test asymptomatic people, and you're only looking for fevers, the entire epidemic control effort in China is based on the SARS experience, which was about fever checks. I mean, I remember I would walk from, say, our office in one part of Beijing to the driver, and then from the driver to drive to some meeting, and then from that meeting to another, a typical sort of journalist day, right? And I would probably have my temperature taken at least a dozen times over the course of the day. When I drove from Beijing all the way out to Shanxi and down into lower Hebei and then back up, did this huge circle that would be sort of, for the non-China familiar, it would be kind of like driving up to Maine, over to Chicago, down to, say, South Carolina, and then back to New York. So it was a pretty good chunk of territory. I would be pulled over and fever checked roughly every 5 to 10 miles.
And essentially, assuming it's the same playbook, which it sounds like
it is
from what we've been seeing as well.
It is.
It just doesn't mean much anymore.
Well, in SARS it worked because as it turned out with SARS, people really were essentially contagious when they had a fever. But the more evidence that comes forward of people transmitting without having a fever, the more we're questioning this entire control effort. If fever check stations are not going to capture all the carriers, then you're not going to stop the epidemic with this as your primary tool. But what tool do we have? We don't have the equivalent of a dipstick that tells you acid or base, you know? I can't stick something in your mouth and it comes back and it says infected. So this is a huge challenge, and it would be a huge challenge in any country, even here in New York City.
Right. You know, as you're talking, I keep thinking about this, the gap between, you know, doctors becoming aware that there was something very serious going on and actual disclosure, which I think is about a month generally accepted, something of that,
roughly
that time. How significant is that, this lack of disclosure? It, if you could comment on that a bit.
Well, there's issues there. The first is, to your prior question where you asked me, well, what about flu? Don't more people get flu? And I told you how exasperated I always get with that question. The other is, oh, it's only 10 cases. Why are you making a big stink about it? Oh, it's only 20 cases. Why are you making, well, it's 40 cases, but it's only 40. So why are you making a stink? The time to respond and stop an outbreak is when it's only 20 cases, only 40 cases. By the time it's a few hundred cases, you lost. It's over, man. You're now dealing with an epidemic, and your whole strategy of outbreak control has been defeated. And it's defeated because of your own complacency, your own unwillingness to take seriously the first seemingly very small number of cases. It's always easier with any epidemic to stop it when the numbers are very small. But what happened in this case is the second part of my answer that's uniquely Chinese. In November, the Xi government rolled out a whole campaign of posters that are sort of like a Marvel Comics drawing. They're very, Superman looking. And they show a person wearing a mask. And it says, be patriotic, don't wear a mask. And the reason is that they've rolled out this massive facial recognition campaign. There's more facial recognition-based policing in China than all the rest of the world combined. And they've added to it this point system.
Social credit system, yes. Right.
And so they were actually trying to get the whole nation to stop wearing masks. Make yourself available to our cameras, please. And on top of it all, of course, she has filled the ranks of government with more and more people who are from his sector of the Communist Party. When I was there for SARS, one of the big sort of puzzles as an outsider was always like, who's really in charge in this room?
Right. There'd be the government person, and then there'd be the Communist Party person that was really in charge. Is that what you're...
And the Communist Party guy has some weird innocuous title, you know, that sounds like garbage collector. And the person you're talking to in the nice suit has the minister of whatever title. But he is scared to death of the guy sitting in the back of the room. And so that used to be the problem, was as the outsider trying to figure out who's really in charge here, who do I really want to get a conversation with. But what she has done, and my former colleague from the Council on Foreign Relations, Elizabeth Economy, has written a fair amount about this, is he has really integrated the party in so much that sort of parallel governance thing doesn't exist as much anymore. Well, that means that a lot more of Xi's future is resting on how he deals with this epidemic. You know, if the party screws this up, the economic and political repercussions are going to be enormous. And many would argue they already did. I mean, certainly that's the implication that all of Li Wenliang's mourners have taken from his martyrdom.
Right.
That he was killed by the party, essentially. Its unwillingness to allow him to warn all of us about this epidemic, and the unwillingness of the party officials inside Wuhan to take seriously the warning that he and other doctors, at least 8 of them, were all either jailed or forced to sign these confessions of rumor mongering.
Right.
And that goes to another reason why we're having so much trouble understanding what's going on in China, is the enormous crackdowns that have been going on now for 5 years with Xi on all social media, so that people just suddenly disappear one day because they, you know, tweeted the image of Winnie the Pooh with Xi's face on it saying something stupid, and boom, you know, say goodbye to your family. Someday maybe you'll return to society. We don't know what happens to all these people. Well, now that's complicated with the epidemic. So all kinds of people are putting out information and trying and posting videos. Many times they disappear, or they're deliberately posting with layer upon layer of anonymity built in to protect themselves. But it means it's really hard to authenticate the information. And then, of course, there are trolls out there posting lies. And some of them traced to Russia, the usual suspects, putting out horribly distorted information and using, in some cases, very old footage of repressive activities in China and claiming, see, this is going on right now, and this is the victim on the ground there has the virus. So it makes it really hard for those of us on the outside to understand actually what's going on and what to believe.
So on top of the structural problems that would just prevent effective reporting, I imagine there's a level of desperation for people that are putting these videos, legitimate videos, up because they know what could happen to them.
Yes.
Right? And you know, the system is structured in such a way that you don't want to say much because bad things will happen.
Well, one of the most popular independent journalists, very young guy who was in Wuhan, has disappeared.
Yes.
And nobody knows what happened to him. And the longer it goes with him disappeared, the more angry people get. You're already seeing on Weibo and so on people likening him to Li Wenliang. So there's already a sense of the repression, the epidemics being used to repress us. And I remember even with SARS, you know, one of the things that the reasons that that was covered up for so long was that by pure coincidence, the very same day that the Central Committee met to decide who should succeed Jiang Zemin and anointed Hu Jintao, that very same day, the first case of SARS staggered into a hospital. And they knew, look, you know, every time we have a transition of power, somebody dies. Let's make this one not turn into a purge. Let's make this one not result in violence. This must be a smooth transition. So there shall be total stability. Nothing shall rock the boat until the People's Party Congress meets in March to certify this and formally, you know, the coronation takes place. So that's when SARS unfolded, but was covered up. And by the time the world knows about it, it's in 30 other countries. And in particular in Singapore and Hong Kong, which and Vietnam, which are facing a really brutal outbreak by then. And it's not until April, after, I forget his name now, the physician who had been in Tiananmen and then leaked the documents, the military physician who leaked documents showing that the military hospitals in Beijing were full of SARS patients. And he leaked them to WHO and to Time magazine. So Time magazine broke the story, complete with photographs of medical charts. And the first response from the government was, oh, this can't be true. And then, oops. Okay, you have a new government now, different leaders. We're not going to say anything bad about Jiang Zemin because he still controls the military. But, you know, cover up is not us. We're admitting we have it in Beijing. But what they didn't think about was as soon as they said, yes, it's true, we have this disease in Beijing, how would the people of Beijing respond? I went down to the train station and watched more than 200,000 people take off all over the whole country, disappearing from Beijing and taking the virus with them.
It's and just so, like this 7 million or odd people sort of leaving Wuhan prior to the quarantine.
Right.
I mean, you're telling me 100 cases, if I recall, it's already game over.
Yeah.
We're talking 7 million people. How many cases among them?
Well,
no
I mean,
idea.
And we probably never really will be able to reconstruct that history and know. But certainly that cover-up has put the people of China at risk and put the whole world at risk.
I mean, I'm thinking, I really hope Leung's predictions don't come out,
Oh, I hope he's totally wrong. Absolutely. I mean, I can't even imagine. You know, we're already in a situation where in almost every press briefing that he does in his now daily briefings on an emergency basis that are coming out of World Health Organization headquarters in Geneva, the Director General, Tedros, every single one of these at some point breaks into a plea, let us maintain global solidarity. Let us please work together to help each other to survive this experience. Stop hoarding masks. Don't nationalize your medical supplies. You know, help one another. And by the way, fund WHO, which has like no money to do this.
Well, but that doesn't ring very true to me, given how WHO treats Taiwan.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, they're
the solidarity issue.
They're left outside, right? I mean,
yeah, but the whole UN system does this. It's not unique to WHO.
Right.
And it's not great. And, you know, it's one of the many things that has kids in Hong Kong in the streets is fear of this turning out to be the way Hong Kong and Macau get treated as well. But when he says solidarity, Tedros is talking about the sort of food chain of medicine, if you will, you know, the supply chain, the sharing genome samples and viral samples, bringing the whole global community together in a kind of solidarity effort to work on the science, on trying to come up with a vaccine, on sharing information that's valuable clinically and valuable in terms of figuring out how to go the next step of control, and then ultimately to maintain the whole supply chain of essential goods and equipment and protective gear.
So where are things with respect to a vaccine?
Well, you know, SARS happened in 2003 and we don't have a SARS vaccine. MERS emerged in 2013 and we don't have a MERS vaccine. And these are close cousins to COVID-19. Certainly, the emergence of COVID-19 has, you know, upped the ante and has encouraged incentives, shall we say, in the pharmaceutical industry, which is loath to make anything that doesn't show high profit potential in rich countries. If the stars had aligned properly so that some sort of appropriate incentive exists for the pharmaceutical industry, and we had a SARS vaccine that had actually by now gone through some clinical trials, we would be able to come up with a COVID-19 vaccine very quickly because they are genetically very similar. And if one worked, the other probably would. But unfortunately, despite attempts by the World Economic Forum and a variety of other entities, the Wellcome Trust and so on, to try and incentivize the pursuit of both MERS and SARS vaccines and to, you know, find the right funding mechanisms to get the science rolling and to get the pharmaceutical industry rolling, we don't have vaccines for either one. So, you know, the most optimistic forecasts I've seen say that we could have one within a year. And I don't understand what Kool-Aid somebody's drinking to say that. Because, you know, there's not a candidate, you know, product sitting on a shelf to go into clinical trials. Now, even if you went into clinical trials with the approval of the Chinese government, executed in China, in the middle of Wuhan, in the middle of an epidemic, you're not going to have, and you're going to do a placebo-controlled trial in the middle of an epidemic. You're not going to have data and results that you can really turn around and say, this works or doesn't work, and this is the appropriate dosing, and this is the necessary adjuvant, and this is how it should be formulated. You won't have those results anytime for many months. And we're not even close. So I don't understand where this one-year figure comes from. Maybe they mean in 1 year we'll know what, at least in theory, a vaccine should be, what it would be made from, and how it might be formulated. But we certainly won't be in clinical trials. So I'm not optimistic that we are going to get out of this crisis via a vaccine, not in the near term, not in its current incarnation. Some have suggested, so there's basically a couple of options now. Some have suggested that as human behavior changes with warming weather, so that, and you know, everybody opens the windows and people go outside and you know, life starts to come back to normal, that the spread of the virus will go down just because of all the changes in human behavior that lower the chances you get a cold in the summer versus a cold in the winter. And certainly that had to have been a contributor with the end of SARS, because it really did end in June of 2003. But with SARS, it ended after a mammoth control effort had been carried out across every inch of China. And it was already waning way before the spring heat hit and the masses poured into the streets to have a good time. The second possibility is that we go into something that's sort of endemic. Yes, there could be a seasonal downturn in the circulation of the virus, but it's not gone. And it returns next winter and becomes a cyclic feature regionally in China and parts, other parts of Asia. That would, of course, be horrible. And one hopes that doesn't happen. The third possibility is that it continues to spread geographically, and that less and less of the geographic spread is connected back to China. It becomes separate spiraling outbreaks in one country or region after another, and that it makes its way down the Belt and Road into sub-Saharan Africa, in which case we are really looking at a nightmare, a nightmare of enormous scale. And I think, judging by the things I'm reading and seeing African leaders say, particularly in the African CDC and so on, and my own many, many years spent in sub-Saharan Africa, I think there's already a sense of doom and gloom, you know, that we will be abandoned if this virus comes to us. If you think China's running out of resources, we don't even have them to begin with. And when you imagine that, you know, China, you can look and see people are using CAT scans, MRIs, advanced support, various kinds of respiratory equipment. Well, all three of those elements are missing in, you know, 90% of hospitals in sub-Saharan Africa. So what is supportive care? And who would enforce a quarantine? And where would people go? And how would any of this even happen on that continent? It's very hard to imagine. And, you know, my fear is that the timing on this in terms of global politics is about as bad as it can be. Because we've turned into an anti-globalization world. All the institutions that are multilateral are kind of in a state of siege right now. The whole UN system, but also dozens of other, you know, not UN institutions. We have record numbers of people in need of humanitarian assistance and no money coming forth to help them. Now just look at Syria. We all stand back watching this country get absolutely destroyed. And so what I fear is that this will just further drive a wedge into what remains of globalization. And as Dr. Tedros pleads for global solidarity, the reality will be quite the opposite, that countries will continue to try and imagine that you can wall off a virus, and that by, you know, blocking airports and blocking people, and of course, in particular, blocking those Chinese, in what will obviously already does look racist at root, as all of this becomes more and more pervasive, that we'll see erosion of what remains of solidarity for other things. That it will affect trade policies and global economics and cultural exchange and everything, so that we kind of retreat back to a balkanized world, you know, full of vitriol, and that would be a horrible outcome.
Based on everything that you've seen and going to all these outbreaks, I know it's very, very difficult to predict anything, right? But based on the trajectory you're seeing right now, based on the available data, based on your experience, where do you think things will go in the next, you know, let's say 6 months?
I think that the answer to that lies with paying really close attention to how this plays out right now in Singapore and Hong Kong. And if they have a really explosive spread inside those very two advanced, small, I mean, high population, but geographically small locations, then I see tremendous difficulty ahead for the whole world. So, you know, I'm keeping my eyes on Singapore and Hong Kong. And it's very interesting to me to watch, you know, the Prime Minister in Singapore held gave a speech to the nation 2 days ago. He was casually dressed, sitting in his living room, or what I guess we're supposed to believe was his living room, like this. And just looking right in the camera, and for about 35 minutes, very calmly went through all the risks, all the steps being taken, what citizens should do, what physicians should do. And it was all just, you know, one of the most transparent, wise speeches I've ever heard about a disease from a head of state. And, you know, Singapore paid a huge price with SARS. Every time I've been back there, I've seen more improvements in infection control in their hospitals, a really close attention to this potential. So now they're being put to the test. If Singapore can't do it, if Singapore can't keep it under control, then we're all screwed, because they've got the best system in the world.
Laurie Garrett, I think we're going to have to end on that. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
That's right.